Hallo, what's up, Kiko? Also,
Hey Ollie, how's it going?
good, man. Just looking at the interface of the new Clubhouse. I can't find the add people button, the little plus. Where's it gone?
It's disappeared. I think you have to, okay, you have to press share and then at the bottom you have invite people.
Where shit? Where is that?
So share should be at the bottom, the second bottom from the left. So it should be chat, share, and then clip. And if you press share, you get the options.
Oh, there you go. See? Things are changing too quickly in Clubhouse, eh? Can't
Things are
keep up.
changing. Right.
Charlie.
Hey, Charlie, what's up, man?
Yo, how's it going?
Good. We finally got you on Clubhouse.
Yeah,
Hey.
first time speaking and listening and using it in any way, to be honest. It's less intimidating than I thought it would be.
Well, welcome to Clubhouse. It's I mean we started this journey on Clubhouse, but we're definitely wondering or looking at alternatives because I feel like the hype is slowly dying down, but it's been a fun app for lockdowns and things like that.
I definitely am just like so Zoom fatigued that like any even moderate alternative is fun. Like one time someone was like, let's do a Google Meets thing, and I was like, wow, what a day to be
Like
alive.
a new, whole new world, man. Cool. We'll give it a couple more seconds for a few more people. We're a little bit early than our usual time, so I think people will pile in a little bit later. Guillaume, what's going on?
Hey guys.
Bonjour,
What's up,
bonjour.
Jim?
Charlie, where are you talking to us from? You're in the UK, right?
South London. Sort of Stockwell near Brixton, if you know it.
I'm in Shoreditch right now.
Cool. It's a much more like architecty area, isn't it?
Yeah,
Shoreditch.
I moved here a month ago. I was trying to obtain the 10-minute life where the office, the gym, and home are all 10 minutes from each other.
The
And it seemed,
coveted
but
walking city,
yeah, yeah. But it's been good so far. Good so far. Anyway, well, let's jump into it. So welcome everyone to our 36th talk. This is also almost our anniversary. Our first ever talk was on the 28th of February. So this is it's our anniversary tomorrow. Faisal Guillaume, I'm not sure if I mentioned that, but we're coming up for 1 year of Architect Network. And this is going to be a talk on number 36 of what is all this faff about and does technology play a role in the solution? And we're here with Charlie Edmonds. It's the founder of FAF. For those of you who don't know, FAF stands for the Future Architects Front, and I'll let him divulge a little bit more about what that is. I didn't realize you're also a fellow Brooks alumni. You studied your undergraduate at Oxford Brookes, then you went to the University of Cambridge for your master's. You founded the Future Architects Front. And one thing I definitely wanted to ask you is what you are currently a dark matter designer. So that was a pretty cool sounding thing for Civic, right?
Civic Square, lots
Well, first
of
of all,
hats.
thank you, thank you for joining, man. And so when did you graduated Brooks? It was in like 2014, was it?
No, I think I started 2014, graduated
Oh, you start, yeah,
2017.
yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry, yeah, I misread that. Well, I graduated. Oh man, I feel a little bit old now. I graduated in 2009. Started in 2000, bang in the recession. But
Right before they got the fancy new building.
yeah, I haven't seen the new building. I was actually trying to come in and do a talk, but I think yeah, it's all changed. But no, thank you very much for coming. and joining us. I think this is a super interesting topic, and obviously, your collective or your movement, I don't know how you actually describe it, is really gaining traction, and I think it's a topic that we need to discuss more as architects. And we've been having discussions, on kind of a similar track, but looking at it from a different way of like the business model of architecture and different ways we could practice architecture and therefore get paid more. But yeah, maybe to kick things off, do you want to give us a little, for those of you in the crowd who are not familiar with FAF, give a little introduction to what the Future Architects Front is?
Yeah, so it sort of emerged from, I guess, the experience of both myself and the other founder, Pretty Mohandas. We both finished our masters in Cambridge, and we sort of had this similar experience where we were looking at the landscape of the profession. And the masters that we'd just finished had been like this incredibly liberating 2 years where we'd got to, do field work, conduct our own research, talk about policy, like economics, politics, everything that holds architecture, essentially. And then as we were looking at these, opportunities for being part twos, it was just all a bit, grim, like the obviously the
It's a good word.
salaries, the amount of experience that's required for what is ostensibly a part of your education. The architectural assistant position is supposed to be part of your education, and yet a lot of practices will ask you to turn up with like 3 to 5 years of experience or something like that. And we basically just kind of realized that profession is in a really dysfunctional place right now. And so the first thing that we ever did was write an open letter to the REBA to essentially try to pressure them into addressing some of the what we saw as the key failings of their institute and the profession at large. And so these were things like addressing unpaid overtime, addressing the way that REBA holds practices accountable for sticking to the Charter Practice Agreement. And generally, it was sort of a letter that was simultaneously trying to sort of, hold REBA to a higher standard, but it was also just a good vehicle for sort of getting these issues into the limelight more, because we ended up getting it covered fairly extensively in the AJ, Building Design, Architectural Review, all kinds of places. So it helped both in terms of, allowing us to sort of leverage an institution like the REBA to start to act on these changes. But it also helped to sort of get the message out more generally to the rest of the profession. So that was kind of how it all started. And then eventually we got a sort of set of commitments from the REBA, which was, far more than I had ever expected at the beginning of the work. And then from there, it just sort of kind of continued to snowball. We've spoken at something like 12 different universities now. We've been asked to write a lot about what we see as sort of like the issues with the profession. And this has spanned from everything from labor rights to equity to climate to sort of all of the, what I personally see as the most pressing issues for architects and people in built environment professions to be responding to right now. So yeah, it's been a bit of a roller coaster, but we just sort of we also recently celebrated our first year of existing, and it's kind of wild to think about, how much has happened in such a short amount of time, which, I'm sure you guys can relate to. But yeah, I guess that's kind of my semi-meandering, poorly recollected version of the last year.
I think it's great. Yeah, I guess I didn't realize you it was your anniversary recently as well. And so we're both like new online babies, I guess. I guess a year is quite a short time, quite a long time in the world of the internet though, but
Yeah, but I mean, something I am encouraged by is that a lot of these movements that I have a lot of respect for, like Architect Climate Action Network, UVW SOAR, Sound Advice, like all of these groups that are kind of small startup groups kind of changing the discourse in the profession right now, none of them are more than 3 years old as organizations. And that, I don't know, that to me is sort of indicative that there's, something in the water right now. Like there's an appetite for some sort of new modes of working as architectural workers right now. So
I mean,
that's all
it
encouraging.
also coincided. Well, I'm sure it's kind of part of the birth of it was I think the pandemic made everyone rethink, their work-life balance, their work situations, and all these other kind of parameters of life, which really got people. There's so much movement in jobs, and what in America, the big what is it they're calling it, the big quit or whatever it is. A lot of people changing
Yeah,
jobs,
empty
and
work.
so I think it's a perfect time for that. Obviously, we're also facing things like major inflation right now, and all these things are kind of converging, it seems. And it's a little, I was like kind of thinking of the different threads we could follow in this conversation, because it's a tricky one how far you zoom out, because it's just, I think the architecture industry, the AEC industry in general, is got just a lot of it's ripe for innovation. It's just very antiquated and so many different things, but I think it's been very commendable to see what you've done with this platform, and you've already got the RIBA to perk that ears up, and I'm sure they keep a close eye on your Instagram feeds.
Yeah, it does seem that way.
Charlie, by the way, speaking of zooming out, how much support do you get from students or members of different professional bodies in other countries? Sorry, there's light problems here in Nigeria. But yeah, how much support do you get? Like, is this problem sort of widespread, or is it specific to the RIBA in the UK?
Yeah, there's so actually, I wonder if I could actually find what our like follower spread is right now. No, I think that that's going to be too much multitasking. But basically, we've got a relatively like obviously the majority of the people who engage with the stuff we're doing are in the UK because that's the specific sort of like legal context that we're operating from. And since so much of what we talk about is to do with like like the pathway to qualification and like policy around the built environment. A lot of it is going to be very like UK centric inherently. But that being said, we do have a decent amount of interactions from, I would say, mostly sort of the rest of Europe and the US. I think it's probably something like a 70-30 split of like people from the UK, the majority, and then sort of 30% the rest of the world. So it's it's definitely I think the issue of like being a worker, being someone who makes money through labor right now is a sort of globally relevant issue, just due to the sort of wider economic trends of the last sort of 40 years. So I think that there's a lot of appetite in a lot of different countries for more movements like this across all professions. So I don't think we're necessarily talking specifically about architecture, but I think the reason why it feels so much more urgent in architecture perhaps is that we have the same sort of, economic context that everyone else is going through, but then we also have this sort of bizarre culture where we sort of our identities become subsumed into our professional role. Like, people identify as architects before they identify as humans. And I think that's something that allows this sort of work to take more, I think it allows it to feel a lot more pressing for a lot of people, and helps people to really sort of feel engaged because of that condition.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I get exactly what you're saying. And I feel like it's almost because as architects, we almost spend more time doing like architecture things than human things, right? Like we spend maybe like 4 hours a day doing human things, and then the rest of the time is just, you know, architecture. But
certainly be that way for sure.
I do feel like a lot of different countries also have the same problems that you're talking about, and perhaps you might, you know, inspire a global movement, you know, that starts against sort of architectural professional bodies, or maybe you might even look into expanding your network. So having, you know, FAF Europe or FAF US or FAF Africa or something like that. Is that something you've thought about, or you're focusing completely on the UK at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, it's not, I guess it's not something that we've put like a huge amount of thought into. And it's come up in a few different ways recently. One way that has come up recently was the, I don't know if you guys know about this, but we came very, very close to getting the first architecture union in the US for something like 80 years recently. The shop architects came very close to unionizing, and then it was sort of quelled by a series of union busting lawyers that the company hired. But essentially, you know, that started us to that it kind of got us thinking, like, yeah, to what extent is this a sort of global movement or global conversation around labor at the moment? And I think that there's definitely a space for us to have this more global view. I don't know if it necessarily is about like us sort of franchising, though, because the thing I'm not really a big fan of in any sort of context is groups that are overly centralized systems. I think that when things become overly centralized, you get institutes like the REBA, for example, who have kind of just become too bloated, and like, you know, all of their focus is on London, and that creates a seemingly endless streams of problems because of that centralization. So I don't know if I would want to see like more FAF groups like outside of the UK, but I would love for there to sort of be almost like a network of, you know, groups that have sort of solidarity and like a shared vision for, you know, a more sort of equitable future of the profession. And this is kind of already emerging a little bit, in the sense that, you know, we're already working with like a bunch of different groups inside the UK, but we've also talked to like the guys who publish the Failed Architecture magazine. They're based in the Netherlands and the US. We've done events with the architecture lobby in the US. We wrote something for a magazine in that was published by ETH Zurich, and like, so there's kind of these like seeds of sort of international collaboration that are already there, and I'm hoping that it's something that we can sort of put more energy and time into in future. It's definitely something that's very, very difficult to coordinate and hold in your mind because of all of the different sort of legal policy contexts that every single one of these groups is going to be operating within. But I think that it is important for the kind of momentum of this work to kind of keep a global mindset. So yeah, I do think that I'm hoping that at some point in this year, we'll have some more sort of intentional connections with similar groups outside of the UK. But I don't know if it'll necessarily be like a FAF America or anything like that. Not yet, at least.
You seem to be like, there seems to be, obviously, those are the US guys from shop that, you know, I'm assuming you guys were connected with and, you know, discussing things. I mean, that was a super interesting case. I'd love to, I mean, it would have been good actually to get them on as well and hear if they're allowed to say it. I don't know how that works, what actually went down. But I think the thing that always comes to, I mean, there's no question that, like, you know, we're all on the same page that architects are, you know, overworked, underpaid, especially in the context of the education taking 7 years compared with what, you know, lawyers or even doctors, particularly in the US, would graduate and earn. The part that I always come back to is, and it would be super interesting if, and I don't know if you guys have done it, but it'd be super interesting to go and do it, is like, does the business model of architecture actually work? And, you know, like a lot of the stuff I read is kind of like this scenario of the, you know, big bad architecture practice making all this money, and they kind of choose not to, you know, choose to keep wages where they are. But my question it would be like, and this is not for you to answer here, but like, I generally would love to know, you know, how much money do architecture firms make, right? Can they really increase architect salaries that much? Because unfortunately, the business model of architecture practices just doesn't work. We've become, you know, we've slowly relinquished a lot of our responsibilities from a long time ago. We don't really make things anymore. That's the question that's always kind of, I've always been curious to find out. I guess, you know, it's hard to get financial, you know, books from all these different architecture firms, and yes, some of that is public knowledge, but it's kind of, you know, you have to really know what you're looking for to troll through. Is that something you guys have looked into or are interested in looking into? I also, you know, I'm very aware that it's just you guys doing this in your own time, and I know just by keeping an Instagram account, it's a lot of work to do that alone. So
Yeah, no, it is something we've looked at. So essentially, I think the key context for this sort of conversation is where architects have historically received their funding. So if you were to go back to the 70s, for example, architects in the UK were doing sort of fairly even amounts of private work and public work. So about 50% of all money that went into architecture professions was public money. Fast forward to today, through sort of, you know, the gradual process of like neoliberalism that's cut down public spending massively, and privatized a lot of our assets, we're now at a point where public spending in architecture in the UK is less than 1% of all architectural work. So we've essentially lost all, like effectively all public work. And, you know, there are groups that are trying to sort of push back against this and like undo this process. Like if any of you know about public practice, for example, they're essentially a placement program that puts architects into planning offices, and they're trying to sort of push back this you know, effective privatization of the architecture profession. And so there's that, which is a key bit of context. And at the same time, you also have the sort of removal of fixed fee scales. So that used to be the thing that would guarantee that an architecture practice would charge a sort of appropriate amount for the work that they've done. So essentially what happened is when that was taken away, we kind of, as a profession, fell into a sort of spiral of undercutting one another until we get to the point today where the work is sort of criminally undervalued. And this doesn't affect all practices equally. Like, obviously, you know, Patrick Schumacher as Zaha Hadid Architects is able to get as much sort of like, you know, like as many sort of like Saudi Arabian projects as he wants right now. They're doing fine for money. But it's more about how it affects the profession sort of generally, since we are a cottage industry, we are mostly made up of small to medium-sized companies. So that's kind of the like financial economic context that we're looking at right now with architects. And whenever we kind of push this idea that young people, architects, architectural workers in general, should be paid more and they should unionize, things like this, a very sort of like common thing that we hear back is that, like, you know, there's literally not enough money to do that. Like, practices aren't making enough money.
Right.
And I think the reason why we support things like unionization, it's not because we think that, you know, all bosses are like hiding a secret stash of money or intentionally underpaying. Some are definitely intentionally underpaying, but like not, you know, we're not making that as like a blanket statement across like all architectural business. Like, a lot of architects are obviously like, a lot of practice directors are obviously, you know, struggling financially a lot as well. But the reason why we talk about unionization is because I think that if we want to address the systemic problems in the profession, we need to change the governance of the profession. Because right now, as a worker, particularly as a young architectural worker, you have essentially zero autonomy in the profession. You do as you're told, when you're told to do it. You have no say in how the profession is organized, how what kind of work we agree to do, any of that. You've got no say at all. So unions, for me, are more about a more equitable distribution of decision-making power more than they are about, like, you know, trying to steal your boss's Rolls Royce or something. Like, it's more about having everyone sort of like a more kind of like democratic decision-making process within a professional context, because I think that's the only way that we're going to be able to actually, you know, take on some of these systemic problems that are resulting in low fees, lack of work, lack of even like respect for the title of architect. Like, I, you know, it really doesn't mean that much to a lot of people these days. And I think the only way we can address that is through, more sort of collective action from within the profession.
I guess the RIBA is a tricky one because it's kind of you're in the chicken before the egg kind of scenario, in that, you know, the RIBA needs practices to pay, well, it needs architects to pay the fees, you know, which are usually paid by the practice you work for, let's say. But then they're the people that have to enforce these rules onto those practices. So it's kind of
the RIBA have almost like a self-imposed redundancy, which is that they're trying to simultaneously represent employers and workers, which, you know, in a lot of situations, those two groups have diametrically opposed interests. So you either go the democratic route, which would mean that you choose to support workers because there's more of them. But usually organizations will go for the route with more finance available, which is the route of the employers, the people who control the capital and control the sort of power and influence within the profession. So that's sort of the inherent like absurdity of a group like RIBA, and that only gets more well pronounced when you see someone like Simon Alford like become the president, you know, like arch architectural boss of architectural bosses. Like, how much is he going to represent the interests of a, you know, freshly graduated architectural assistant? My sort of assertion is very little.
He's getting paid quite well, according to your Instagram page, right?
I mean,
allegedly getting paid quite well, I guess.
So Simon Alford is the president, which doesn't technically come with a salary. That gets a stipend, which is about, I've heard it's in the ballpark of 50 grand. So that's definitely not too bad. Allegedly one day of work a week is what I've heard from inside of RIBA. But the person who is getting paid astronomically well is the CEO of RIBA, So
Okay, sorry, I was
that's a guy
confused the
called
two.
Alan Valance who's on the board. And if you look at the, because Reeb is a charity, they have to be transparent about how much they're paying people. The top
Okay.
paid person in Reba is earning over 300 grand a year. And so obviously you don't know exactly who that is,
Yeah,
but
but
you can fairly safely assume who that is. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of where we're at right now. Like the Royal Institute of British Architects, the CEO of that organization is earning over 10 times the amount as an entry level architectural graduate. So, you know, say what you will about that.
So there's two little threads that popped up. Obviously, it was a little bit tongue in cheek, but obviously with the Architect Network, we set out because we also saw a gap in architecture education, which is, another discussion. I've felt like as architects we've kind of fallen behind the technology curve, and I think at university I see more and more students coming out, and that they're not really given the tools and technologies they need to become, modern day architects, and maybe reduce these crazy hours a little bit by the use of software and stuff like that. But two things that popped up, tying, does technology have a role in this at all? Like, obviously not, but it's not the silver bullet. But I think there's some things that you've mentioned that are kind of interesting. One, which is a very big blue sky idea, and that I never really put into context that idea of all that public projects disappearing, right? And so now we just compete for these private projects. I wonder if this new frontier of the metaverse and NFTs and architects having this new frontier to create projects, right? There's now architects getting hired to create, Minecraft buildings, or a virtual exhibition space, or a virtual store. I thought that could be an interesting way to utilize what we do as architects, because you think about, most architecture practices, I think, the vast majority of work is never built or turned into an actual product. It sits on your servers, and it could be used or tweaked to become an NFT or to become some kind of virtual experience, and therefore bring in a new revenue. Very blue sky idea, but that was one kind of thread I thought would be interesting just to bring up. The other one, which is a bit more deeper, which we've discussed before, and I think Faisal might also find this interesting, is like the whole, and I don't know how kind of into the whole blockchain space you are, Charlie, but the latest thing that's, and we had a talk on blockchain a few weeks ago, and we got to talking about DAOs, which is decentralized autonomous organizations, and which are kind of organizations that are kind of brought together through some kind of blockchain platform, which enables a kind of decentralized way of a democratic approach to creating a company. For example, they had one of the examples that came up was they were called like the crypto baristas, and it's an NFT. You buy one of these little crypto barista icons kind of thing, and by buying the NFT, you then got a some kind of ownership, I think, or some kind of say in how the coffee shop, which was actually a real physical coffee shop in Brooklyn, I think, was going to be run. And you could say, no, I don't want us to serve cold brew, or I do want us to serve cold brew, or whatever. And I thought there could be something interesting in that as a new model for architecture practice, as like a true collective of individuals that are some kind of DAO where, me, Faisal, Charlie, Guillaume, we join this network, and I don't know, projects come up, and it's transparent. This is how much of the fees are there. This is what we need to break even, and this is what your percentage of the project would be based on your level or input or something like that. Like a very transparent way of bringing in projects, and you could also tie it into, remote working, and you could do this any place in the world, or work part time. If a project comes up and you want to participate in it, you kind of participate in the project, and you also have a say in how this, network of architects, makes decisions and things like that. I thought that is kind of an interesting one that I don't know if that's something you've looked into or heard of before. Again, I'm no expert in it, but those are two things that kind of popped up as we're talking, of like a DAO architecture practice and a new frontier for architects to make a bit of money.
Yeah, I mean, so I think any exploration of organizing structures which are sort of more, democratic, more equitable, more sort of shared accountability, I think any exploration into that is great. I tend to be a little skeptical of a lot of the particularly like crypto and NFT markets, mainly because of the like crypto and like Bitcoin in particular, for example, like it's supposedly decentralized but majority owned by a very tiny percentage of people. So I do kind of see a lot of the same issues of like kind of neoliberal capitalism like being replayed at like 10 times speed in a lot of these sort of systems. And I mean, for me, I would say my kind of larger view, the most optimistic version, sure, is one that's not rooted in sort of like green growth or new sort of technology saving us. I generally tend towards more ideas of like degrowth, where it's more about kind of actually scaling back production and distributing more equitably what we already have, because we are already overproducing so much across like global economies. And the problem is not necessarily that we're not producing enough or we need to produce more of something else. It's that we need better governance of these systems of production and better distribution of them. So, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, blockchain is essentially a sort of ledger which kind of keeps track of like addresses and transactions and things like that. So I'm sure that, there's probably some applicability of a system like that in terms of keeping track of things like production, distribution of production, distribution of resources, etc., etc. And yeah, I'm sure a lot more sort of computer science-y minded designers than I will find some sort of incredible ways to incorporate that into some really effective work. But I generally tend to sort of be cautious about any vision of the future which is encouraging us to produce more. There's a very sort of specific climate budget that we have left before, we reach sort of irreversible global temperature change.
But
So
you mean it in terms of literally, in our context, building more. Because we,
well, any production, I mean, like, if you like host a server, like that's a type of production. That's you're sort of using energy to host a server, and that has sort of material energy consequences. So I mean, I mean production in a very broad sense of the word, where like any sort of process of extraction, conversion, use, waste, these are all processes of production that I think that we need to sort of have a kind of long-term view of them in terms of sort of like cost benefit, cost being cost to sort of like our rapidly depleting carbon budget, and benefit being what's the material benefit that this brings to people in the future.
Is it not? I mean, growth is inevitable, right? Is it not?
I don't think
And
so.
my argument was a bit like, wouldn't it be how can we innovate that the growth that would, let's take like literally buildings, for example. We're going to need to build more, We also need to build it faster. So how can we find a way that's more sustainable, or vastly more sustainable than the way we have now?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really an advocate of like building more, building faster. I mean, so like if you look at the predicted sort of project completion by like 2050, for example, we already have 90% of the built environment that we would supposedly have by 2050. So our focus
Really?
should be vastly more oriented towards what's already there and how we can improve it. You know, this is why I'm such a big advocate of initiatives like retrofit, things like that, because at the moment, you know, in the US, for example, putting a new oil pipeline in is wasting less energy than is currently being wasted through the windows and walls of poorly insulated homes in the US. So we have a vastly sort of misdirected focus right now in terms of you know where we're putting our design sort of skills and attention. I personally think that where the world needs design and architecture the most right now is in the built environment that's already there, because a huge amount of it is of very poor quality. And the sort of energy that's wasted through our sort of poor quality housing that we have right now is one of the most significant contributors to emissions right now. So I tend to you know always have this sort of idea that as architects, I think our most sort of hopeful role in the future is not necessarily tied to more extraction, more production. It's more tied to this idea of like stewardship of what's already there and improving the sort of quality of life for people who are already living in these spaces. You know, not to say that every architect has to do this. This is just kind of like my personal approach as to like where I want to put my time and where I would love more architects to put their time. And you know, I think, yeah, so like you mentioned earlier, my sort of job title of dark matter designer, and that's where that comes from, because it's essentially a metaphor, which is that dark matter is this like invisible force in the universe that is kind of dictating a lot of physical laws of how the universe works, but we can't see it, it's unobservable. We only know it's there because of the effects that it has. And essentially, the metaphor of like my role at Civic Square is looking at sort of like the dark matter of the way that we run our societies. So things like finance, policy, regulations, all of these things that are kind of in the background of our systems of governance and economics that we don't usually look at. Essentially, my work kind of revolves around dragging those out into the light and trying to sort of visualize the way that these invisible systems influence things like carbon emissions of the built environment, and the way that architectural workers materially impact the built environment, for example. These are things that usually kind of go on somewhat behind closed doors or behind closed systems. So a big part of you know what I do, not just at FAF but also in my sort of full-time work, is about trying to almost like map out these systems and think about where in a very you know resource-stretched world that we're in right now, where is our kind of time and energy best concentrated.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I think, I mean, it surely has to be a mix of enhancing what we already have, but also building in the future for in more sustainable ways. I don't know if anyone wants to raise their hands. I think maybe I'll open it up if anyone has any other kind of questions to bring up or want to kind of add to the conversation. As usual, raise your hand and we'll bring you up to the stage. The kind of last broad topic I was gonna touch on is like the actual education system itself of architecture, and whether you guys are kind of obviously you guys are kind of talking about that space, but what do you think of like the growth of architecture apprenticeships? And I know right now there's a big thing you were advocating that there's a forum of how to kind of potentially improve architecture education and make it less long and expensive now. I mean, I was the first year that they tripled fees
That's great.
for my year, and that was from 1,000 to 3,000, and then I forgot what year they tripled it again. It must have been close to
I think it
your
was a
generation,
couple of
right?
years before me, so yeah, probably would have been around like 2010, 11, 12, around that time.
Yeah, it seems a short time. They tripled and tripled, but it puts architecture a long way out for many people. I mean, I'm still paying my student loan now, and I was paying a third of what people are paying now.
Yeah, so
So yeah, I don't know if
with
that's another area that you're kind of taking
yeah.
on, or like, obviously that we're kind of touching that on that ourselves, but in a very, very niche way around, teaching technology, and our goal is to make resources to learn things as accessible as possible. But of course, we're still, a business and need to fund future courses. But yeah, what's your view on
Yeah,
the education system?
so I think the main thing that we've done with this is we put out an education survey about 6 months ago, and it was kind of sort of like semi like hilarious results where we asked I think the most illuminating question was it was what did we say? We asked, do you think education should be more oriented to practice, or do you think it should be more oriented towards some, like, towards another sort of focus, essentially? So, like, should it be more like practice or not? And we got kind of like a 30-30-30 split of people being like, everyone sort of disagreeing on what they wanted from architectural education. Some people wanted to be super practical, some people wanted to be very academic, some people didn't even know what they wanted. They wanted it to be kind of like more explorative, open. So like no consensus at all. But the only place there was consensus was, do you think architectural education needs to change? And that was like 95% of people said yes. So there's kind of a really funny
It's a
situation where everyone agrees that it needs to change, but no one can agree on how. And what that kind of said to me in interpreting this data was that the problem is homogeneity. The problem is that architectural education is too similar across the board. So if you're someone who is interested in very tangible, very practical versions of architecture, there's not really a place that does that. If you're someone who wants to be very, very academic, very sort of rooted in architectural theory, there's not really a place that specializes in that. You have to kind of go to a university that tries to do it all, sort of. And so our main kind of takeaway from that survey was that there needs to be a lot more sort of heterogeneity in the way that people can qualify as architects. And interestingly, we actually got to sort of say this directly to the ARB, because around the time that we did this study, they decided to start consulting on reforms for architectural education. So we essentially told them, everything that we'd found out, all the research that we'd done. And then they put out a consultation, which was essentially gathering people's opinions on how architectural education should be changed. But their priorities were very much in line with the results of our research. Their priorities were very much about opening up the pathway to qualification to more backgrounds, both individual and professional. and about sort of creating a more diverse and representative body of architects. Essentially, those were kind of the goals that they had, and the reforms, they have an ambition to make the reforms sort of like the most ambitious reforms to architectural education in 50 years. So I'm hoping that, you know, when they're eventually announced, that they live up to this. But that's kind of the main bit of work that we've done in the sort of education realm, was that survey, and then the sort of work that we did with the ARB before they released this consultation. So there's a chance that the entire part 1 to 3 system that we have in place now could be scrapped. I wouldn't be sorry to see it go. So, you know, we're at an interesting point right now where we're kind of on the precipice of some significant change to architectural education. But, you know, we're kind of waiting with bated breath to see what that will be.
Are there any universities that you work at? Like, for example, isn't the London School of Architecture is a little bit more... Mm. Progressive in this area?
Yeah. So they are very much rooted in practice. The idea is that you work sort of, I think it's like 2 or 3 days a week at a practice while doing your master's. And
it's not free, is it? Or is it?
So originally the amount the pay from the work you did cancelled out the tuition fees. Idea is that, I mean, it's not free because you're working to do it, but, like, you know, it's a more inclusive financial model than ever. Net zero. So it's more inclusive than every other university out there right now. And I don't think it's quite zero now. I think you do have to pay a little bit now, but you know, it's still better still. And I mean, I have a lot of respect for LSA for, like, trying to shake up the model in a way that I don't think many other universities have really been successful in doing. But I think the problem is that if you're an educator right now and you want to do something differently, you are hindered at every step by groups like the REBA and the ARB. Because the more you deviate from the prescribed curriculum, the more you risk losing your accreditation from these bodies. That's kind of where our focus was kind of mainly at when we were looking at education. It was more of the ways that universities were interacting with these regulatory bodies.
Interesting. Yeah, if anyone has a question, speak now, forever hold your peace. Raise your hand, we'll bring you up. We'll bring you up to the stage.
Faisal's
coming in.
Yeah, you know, I love the idea of having almost like specialized schools for architecture, right? Because personally, I would, you know, I'd love to go to sort of a research institution for architecture and study, you know, whether it's like philosophies of architecture or theories of architecture, research and history and all that. But it also gets me thinking, like, how much of that is to do with the nature of architecture itself, right? I feel like the lack of specialized schools might be a result of how architecture is as a discipline, because we're almost like, in general, we're almost like jack of all trades, right? We have these conversations a lot, Ali, about sort of the super user versus the specialist. And I think perhaps that's the debate, you know, universities are also having, right? Whether to gear people into becoming specialists or sort of the super users or sort of generalists who can curate a whole process of, you know, getting from concept to actual finish or completion of a project, which takes a lot of sort of, a lot of general knowledge about a lot of different things. So I don't know, honestly, I don't think there is an answer to it, but it's an interesting conversation to have, whether schools are trying to create sort of the architect in terms of like a generalist, or maybe there's a new profession, there's new like specialized professions within architecture, like, you know, the same way you have like interior architects, landscape architects, etc. Maybe there's specialized subfields of architecture as opposed to architecture in general, right? I'm not sure what the answer would be. I'm not sure what's what. I'm not sure if there's a single answer that every school should implement, right? Because it's also different in different countries and different regions, and what their sort of situations or conditions are. It's
Yeah.
just, yeah.
I mean, I think that, yeah, that definitely, I think, reflects the research that we did, which, yeah, like you say, kind of doesn't point towards a sort of solution, but more indicates that the ideal outcome would be greater choice, greater diversity, greater routes into finding how you want to practice architecture. Because right now, the idea of architectural practice is very overwhelmingly dominated with our understanding of architectural business. But, if you kind of think about it, like who said that the current business model of architecture gets to take ownership of the idea of architectural practice? Like when was this agreed? Why isn't someone who's, I don't know, developing like amazing, beautiful origami structures in their backyard, why doesn't that count as architectural practice? Like all of these things, I think, are really important not to only consider in terms of the future of education, but also to consider in terms of like, again, like governance and power in the profession and who gets to decide what is and what is not architectural practice. These things always kind of like circle back around to each other for me, I think.
Is there a democratic way of doing that that would also protect the profession as a whole?
To
Because
open
essentially,
up universities to having more like specialisms, do you mean?
no. I mean, in terms of like governing who becomes an architect.
I mean, the so at the moment, in the UK at least, the title of architect doesn't protect anyone because the title of architect is literally just a title. There's nothing that you can only do if you're an architect. Architects have no protection of function. So at the moment, the title is really just kind of like a badge or an idea of professionalism. It doesn't actually protect anyone from anything because you don't need to be an architect to do architectural work. So at the moment, we're not really losing anything in terms of safety by. Like the only thing that changes if we let more people become architects is that the assumption about what an architect is will get spread out more. But like I said, at the moment there's no actual protection of function in being an architect. So the kind of safety angle of it is a little tenuous already.
Oh wow, that's super interesting. Yeah, I didn't think about it that way. I guess, but letting more people become architects sort of opens it up for example, I see there's always a lot of court cases about non-architects signing off on buildings in the UK and then getting, taken to court by either the RIBA or the ARB and.
Yeah. So basically, what becoming an architect gets you, what the title gets you, is more liability. So if you present yourself as an architect, you have more liability. And if you present yourself as an architect without being on the ARB register, then you can be taken to court for it. But a developer who doesn't claim to be an architect, but still offers architectural work, they're absolutely allowed to do that, and there's no problems with that. The only reason people get taken to court is if they claim to be architects, or if they are architects and they aren't working according to like the standards of the ARB, that kind of thing. So in very sort of material terms, the title mainly gives you extra liabilities, but it doesn't necessarily give you the power to do anything that you couldn't do before.
Right, that makes sense. That makes sense. I'd love to see if there's perhaps a case study, like a country that doesn't have the same policy and how how the built environment is, and perhaps it's better, right? Perhaps the architects are happier and the built environment is better for it.
Yeah, that exists. I think I could be misremembering. It could be another country, but I think Finland, I think once you finished your master's or something, I believe you just immediately have the title. And, as far as I'm aware, buildings aren't just falling on people on a day-to-day basis over there. So, my kind of inclination is that, maybe gatekeeping the title a bit less wouldn't do us any harm and might actually do us some good in terms of making it something that's more relevant to more people.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a fair point. That's a fair point. I know Lima wanted to ask a question. Yeah.
Good to see you.
Yeah, hi, Ollie. Thank you for joining. No worries. Thanks for this room. Hi, Charlie. Yeah, there's been like so many points. I don't even know where to begin. But I just want to say that I absolutely love FAF and the work you guys are doing. I follow the Insta stories daily. And Yeah. But it's great. And I love the naming and shaming of the companies and the student testimonials and all of that, which is great. And I think obviously having the the different write-ups in the AJ and the zine and things like that is also good. I guess I would just maybe make a point to say that I think as architects, we tend to always talk to architects with architects and it kind of stays within our bubble. I'd love to see one of these articles like be on the Daily Mail or the BBC or something. Yeah, yeah. It's almost like we all know that there's a problem. And so a lot of times, when I see these student testimonials and especially what's happened in the past with, I think, UCL and things like that, it's shocking, but it's not surprising to myself who, went through architecture and is an architect. It's like, yeah, that pretty much happens in probably all universities here. But I guess the annoying thing is just when you talk to people outside of architecture and they just assume, that we are rich beyond our means and we're, living it up. And and it's just like, no. And I try to always tell like all my friends from, outside of architecture, like, we really have it like super shit, like, sorry to say, but it's just, it's not a sustainable profession. And even to call it a profession at this point with all the struggles and all, the crap pay that we have to deal with and the long hours, it's almost like, is it even worth saying that it is a profession? Because personally, I just don't see it like that anymore. I mean, if someone tells me that this is a professional career, I'm expecting some kind of great benefit that comes with it, and you'd want to put yourself on the caliber of those who are doctors, those who are lawyers, and we just aren't there yet. We're actually so far away from that. And I do agree that, the whole process of part one, two, and three, it's just such a drag. Like, I literally just recently finished my part three after graduating in 2012, I've just gotten my part three the end of last year. I put it off because I was just like, do I really need this? Do I really need to have this architect title? I was still doing architecture and I was still working in a lot of, good firms and stuff, but it was hindering kind of my paid progress. And, now that I've finally done it, it's sort of like, okay, I'm still in the same, the same position really. And I definitely think that the part three course is amazing. I do think the part three course, I mean, I've learned a lot of stuff during that course, but I definitely think it should be something that we do within the master's year, which should be part of the MPNL, lecture series and stuff. So that when we come out graduating, we are automatically architects. Like this whole dragging out of part three, paying extra for PEDRs, having, paying actual lecturers just to sign your sheets off. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. I just don't know why we allow this to happen. So that's one thing. And then The last thing would be, I mean, I think I'm very, very fortunate and lucky because I think Ollie and maybe Charlie, since I graduated in 2012, and I'm actually an EU student, so I studied in Scotland where I literally paid zero fees. don't ask me how or how this happened. I actually didn't know. I paid in international fees in my first year, and they actually called me in to the cash office and were like, you're an EU student. You don't need to pay international fees. And I was just
Wow.
absolutely floored. So it was great. And I think in 2012, when I graduated, that's when they brought in the extra higher fees and stuff. And, I just thought like, oh my God, I mean, if I had to pay these fees, there's no way I would have been able to afford to go into architecture. So I know I'm super, super lucky. And it's really just disheartening that it used to be so much better, and it's just, kind of went backwards. And looking at also the fees of places like the AA or UCL and stuff, I'm just like, 40K it reaches up to for 1 year. I mean, I don't know. This is it's and when you graduate, you're not even going to be earning 40K in a year until you've got about 5, 6 years experience. So yeah, there's just so much that's going on that I think will take a long time to sort of put back into place and make people actually feel that architecture or being an architect is a sustainable career choice. Because you don't want to end up being working in a company, becoming a principal in a company and earning, 55, 60K. I mean, it's just I just don't know how that works. But yeah, I mean, the way that I moved around, I just quit every 2 years, moved from company to company. That's how I got my higher salary every time I moved. I also worked abroad, so I think other countries kind of value architects a bit more. So if you go to the Middle East, for example, I was absolutely floored with the fees that they're offering architects. It's pretty much almost double what you'd be earning in the UK. Places like Singapore, Hong Kong is a little bit better. So yeah, I don't know. It's just something to think about.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's kind of like a few things that came up. I mean, one kind of big thing for me is like this idea of professionalism and, trying to interrogate like what does that even mean? Like, what does it even mean to be a professional? And in my I personally believe that the only thing that seeing yourself as a professional achieves is to obfuscate your actual sort of economic condition, which is that you are a worker, right? Like, at the end of the day, if you are having to do a 9 to 5 to trade your labor for a salary so that you can survive, you're a worker. Like, the only other option there is being someone who benefits from capital, be that in a company they own, be that in investments, be that like whatever. So essentially, I personally don't really hold this idea of like professionalism in very high regard, because I think the only thing it achieves is to kind of like hide what our actual like position in the world is, which is that we're workers. And as soon as we understand that, we can start to see opportunities to connect with other workers, both within the profession and without, and kind of collectively bargain for more equitable distribution of decision-making powers, but also of the income of the construction industry as a whole, for example. So that's one big thing. Another thing is that I think the thing you said about connecting with people outside of the profession is a really, really, really important point, not just for the work of like, FAF or whatever, but just for the profession as a whole. And I think we've seen kind of glimpses of that happen, like you said, that there was an article about UCL in The Guardian, for example. There was I think Ollie Wainwright has written some things about like the REBA and like salaries of architects in The Guardian a few times as well. So there have been little like forays into what I suppose you'd call mainstream media. But even that, I personally don't think really goes far enough, because even publications like that are only so accessible. Like, only so many people have the time to actually sit down and read an article in the day. Like, so I that actually connects to the reason why I chose not to become an architect, which I don't know if I've even made this clear, but like, I did my master's and then I just I went to work as a designer for Civic Square, because I sort of looked at what the profession does, and I looked at who the profession is interested in and talks to, and it's not most people. It's interested in other architects, and it's interested in clients who represent maybe like 1% of the population. So the thing I love about the work I get to do now, which I'm incredibly lucky to have found a group that does this, but the work I do at Civic Square now is all about trying to organize mass retrofit alongside homeowners and tenants in Birmingham. So we're actually like in the streets, on the ground, talking to people in the built environment about how they would like the built environment to change. And then we're organizing and designing ways to make that happen. We're talking to policymakers, we're raising funds, and we're actually, doing the very frustrating and sticky work of like trying to kind of find our way through a very kind of backward system in order to get the changes that we need to happen through. But the kind of interesting thing for me was that I essentially realized that for me to do the sort of architecture work that I want to do, I have to leave the architecture profession. So it's an interesting thing of like, are you sort of tied to this idea of professionalism, this idea of the architect, more than you are tied to the architectural work that you originally like first applied to do when you were like an 18-year-old? Like, how many people apply to university and they're like, oh God, I can't wait to get ARB certified? No one really cares about that to begin with, right? Like, you do it because you care about the work and you care about the impact. And then gradually, as you become more and more institutionalized, it becomes more about the title, it becomes more about the certifications and the letters after your name. And you kind of lose track of like why you even started to do this to begin with. And I think any opportunity to reconnect with that, be it working outside of the UK, be it like finding ways to kind of like gain more autonomy within your practice, be it doing what I did and just like leaving the profession entirely, I think that is kind of the main challenge that a lot of particularly young architectural workers have to overcome right now, is finding a way to reconnect with the work that they originally set out to do.
No, 100%, definitely. I completely agree, and the work you're doing sounds super amazing. I think, I was definitely the same on the same wavelength. Like when I left my master's, and I was like, I don't need a title. I don't care about the papers, And I went and did, kind of deviated to urban design and planning, which I absolutely loved. But it was almost like by the time I reached a certain kind of years of experience, I sort of. It annoyed me a little bit that I couldn't say I'm an architect, right? Just because of this whole like having to do your part three thing. And I'm just like, surely there should be other ways that you can, like why would you need to go and have to do that, right? And then you've got some other sort of loopholes as well, where you've got EU architects that graduate with a master's and then they can come to the UK and just automatically go and register with the ARB, you know? And it's just like, how does that work, you know? So there's just all these kind of things. And, you know, I just decided when it was Bre like, not Brexit, when it was COVID, just because I had some spare time, and I was like, oh, maybe I should just, you know, go ahead and do this now and just go through it. And I was very, I actually did it really, really enjoy the course. But I remember in my oral examination, where you have to basically in your case study put down your fees for like the resourcing of your team and stuff and the budgets and things. I've increased people's budgets by like 20% and things like that, and I increased the design fees by, you know, an extra, I don't know, I think technically it should have been like 8% or 5% of the construction fee. I put it up to like 15%, and they questioned me about it. You know, they were like, ooh, why would you put 15%? And I'm like, well, why not? I'm an architect. I can do whatever I want. And they were just like, you know, well, if you can negotiate that, but we don't think you'd probably get it. And I was like, well, you know, I don't know, like, why we are being taught to undersell ourselves, right? So that's how I felt through the part three process. It's like we are literally being taught to reduce our fees, and we're not being taught, you know, how to negotiate, how to actually put forward why we deserve to, you know, have these design fees set at a higher rate and all these kind of things. So I think that part for me was a bit disappointing. But yeah, I think something to look into, really.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, we're definitely being trained according to this idea of like current economic realities, rather than being trained in a way that makes you sort of challenge these norms and think about how you could be part of an organized effort to sort of restructure the way that these systems are currently working, and the sort of power that the architect has in the larger sort of construction industry. Yeah, no, I mean, like this is why we're doing FAF, because like as far as I'm concerned, the only way that we're going to change things like that is through just organizing at a mass scale everyone who is not benefiting from the system as it is, which is a lot of people, and use our sort of collective power in order to kind of force this sort of change where we want to see it. So yeah, it's, you know, it always comes back to that sort of, you know, motivation for why we're doing this, for why we're organizing in this way. It's all very much entangled, and if you pull on any thread, you'll always kind of end up back there for me.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Well,
definitely. It's awesome.
keep up the good fight.
I'll
This is, no,
be
that's a
watching, Charlie.
yeah,
I'll
totally.
be on the Insta stories
Amazing.
daily.
Thank you.
Well, dude, thank you so much for joining. I think we'll cut it off there. I know we you got to run before 5, but we've had a good hour and a half of your time. So thank you so much for joining, man. I think keep doing what you're doing. It's really awesome to see the effect that you're already having on the industry. If anyone that's not already following FAF, you can find them on Instagram at fa.front. Or just look up Future Architects Front. Give them a follow on Instagram and give Charlie a follow here on Clubhouse. Hopefully we'll see you back here another time, Charlie, for some of our other talks.
Yeah,
I don't know if there's
I heard he
anything
was in
you
now.
any shout if there's any shout outs you want to give for anything that's coming up for in the world of FAF or anything you're doing, go ahead to let the people know.
Yeah, so one piece of research that we're doing now that I'm really excited about is in collaboration with a guy called Douglas Spencer, who used to teach at the AA. He's now a professor at University State Iowa, I believe. He's been kind of doing a lot of similar work as us, but like in the space of academia, in terms of sort of critiquing the profession. And essentially, we've teamed up with him to do a bit of a study on architectural workers in London specifically. So if anyone is an architectural worker in London, or if anyone knows of anyone who is an architectural worker in London, I would encourage them to check out in the link in our Instagram bio. There is a link called the What Are You Working For survey. And essentially, this is going to be compiled into hopefully a very detailed piece of research that maps out the current state of architectural labor in London, but also maps out what are the repercussions of architectural labor in London. So what is the actual material result of being an architect today? What do all those hours of unpaid overtime actually put out into the world in a material sense? So yeah, if anyone is interested in contributing to that, that would be amazing and help our future research very much. And I'd also encourage people to read an article on failed architecture, which is called Death to the Calling. And I think that is really illuminating and sort of provides a great context for all of the work that we're doing. Like if anything I've spoken about today, you were like, ah, that doesn't really make any sense. I don't get that. This article, I think, does an amazing job of explaining things in a way that I think will just contextualize a lot of what we've spoken about today. So that's Death to the Calling by Marissa Courtwright.
Awesome. I'm looking it up now. Oh, there you go. Faisal's on it. He's posting
Amazing.
it. Yeah, I've just added the link. And Charlie, not to give you more work to do because I know you have your work cut out, but it would be amazing if you could document this whole process and put it out as a, either like as a documentary or as a book, sort of publish it so that other countries or other people in different regions could also implement the same thing. Because I'd love to see this implemented in Nigeria, Ghana, Togo, the UAE, China, etc.
Yeah,
It's
totally,
really amazing.
totally. If this goes the way we want, then we'll absolutely like open source all of the tools we've used in the research. And yeah, we'll definitely invite anyone to reproduce it for the context that they're in. But yeah, no, we're 100% on that open source mentality, so I'm very happy to do that.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Awesome. I'll definitely go and check the links out. I've pulled them up right now. So yeah, awesome. Thank you so much again for your time. Thanks everyone for joining as usual. You can stay tuned on what's going on in Architect Network on our Instagram page. We will be announcing our Grasshopper Masterclass very soon. It's going to be a two-day masterclass on how to learn Grasshopper at the end of March. But stay tuned and we'll post it up. Otherwise, Charlie, thank you again for joining us. Hope everyone has a good Sunday, and we'll see you next week.
Cheers. Thanks, guys.
Bye, guys.
Thanks, everyone. Cheers. Bye.